Alrighty, thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on Friday, February 3rd. Thanks very much for tuning in. I appreciate that. We're going to talk a little bit later in the program. Beth Koblinner has written a book about, this is such a topic. It comes up all the time, but how to make your kids money geniuses, even if you aren't. And she has an interesting idea about paying kids for chores when you start to talk about money with kids and stuff. So we'll kick that around. Super Bowl ads and social messaging. That's sort of the tack we'll take later in this half hour. Right now, Andrea Haines is in the studio. She's the editor for Blue Sky Innovation. You see that in the Chicago Tribune and at chicagotribune.com as they cover the tech and innovative world of Chicago. Andrea, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Good to see you.
All right, so we're going to start with a court hearing that came, I think it was out of Washington, D.C., or nearby this morning about this travel ban put in place, the temporary ban by President Trump. And the government says that 100,000 visas were impacted by that. That's way beyond what I expected.
That's a very big number.
And these are people who, I mean, I'm assuming we're not all coming in this week, but had their visas applied for or were in a position that way. I was trying to get a breakdown of it, but that's how many people just from these four countries are impacted by the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think you see across the media just a wide range of stories of everyone from infants who need surgery to old people to tons of people in between and working people,
right,
which, of course, we've been covering at Blue Sky.
Well, that's the thing, and the impression I get is that it covers or impacts the tech world more than other worlds. I don't know. Is that a fair thing to say?
To some degree, it does. I've also been curious to know just if people in the tech world are a little more able or vocal about speaking out. Because I, even covering this community and knowing that many people have this sentiment because I follow them on Twitter, I know them, I was still a little bit surprised at the extent to which they just came out swinging, which
right.
is what we said in the headline. They just were not, where some of the Fortune 500 CEOs or things like that were holding back a little bit or were a little bit slow to react. I feel like the tech community came out strong and hard and fast.
So what are you saying? You're saying that that's because they're used to the new ways of communication, or that it's just a new mindset, or what's the difference?
I think it might be some of all of that. I think there's also a really interesting sort of consciousness that's taking place about what you expect of people and when they speak out. And I think there are issues where maybe business leaders feel they're best not getting into
right.
the fray and staying above it, or however they view that. But I also think there are people that, if they have a young workforce, if they have a diverse workforce, to those people, these are human rights issues. And it's not something that, do you want to go work for a company that's doesn't have your back? It gets into some of those kind of issues, which I think are just very interesting.
Well, it seems, though, that a lot of the people speaking up, or a lot of the people who work at the companies where the CEOs are speaking up, are immigrants. I mean, it's a very immigrant-rich culture.
Definitely. Lots of immigrants at these companies. We do a feature called Inside Job at Blue Sky, and often, we talk to immigrants for those, and
right.
you just see how many of those people with tech skills are coming into some of these jobs.
This show has been so good for my pronunciation because I've had to learn to say so many different things. So interesting thing you said as well about the differences in how sort of the staid company CEOs react to these younger, more versatile companies. But, I mean, I was reading statements even from Ford and others sort of speaking out about it.
Yeah, many of them came around even after the weekend,
too. They
so
followed
just
that
maybe
way,
there was a little bit of a lag on that.
But you can get in trouble, right? So today the president met with business leaders, and the CEO of Uber was on this council that was going to meet. And is it true I heard they lost 200,000 app subscribers because of his participation in this business council?
Yes, which he wound up dropping out of, but there were just tons of negative feedback there. And again, I think then you're looking at a different, their employees who aren't exactly employees, but their drivers, are very diverse. The people that use that kind of service, of course, are urban, they're younger people, they're very diverse, and they came out strongly about it as well.
Okay, you're not in the business of opinion, so I'm going to ask you for yours anyway. No, I won't, but it strikes me, it's like, well, okay, Tesla, Tesla CEO, Elon Musk is in this council and at the meeting, and he says, look, I don't agree with what the president does in a lot of his positions, but I want to be at the table. That's why I'm there. It seems to me that if I, and I do have an app for Uber, I would rather have my guy participating in the conversation than just shutting himself out.
And that's definitely one way of looking at it. I think, I think here's the thing about this, and I agree, like, opinion isn't my place, but I don't think it's a partisan issue to say that the way things rolled out
Oh, it was a bad thing.
Were maybe not ideal for people, even if they might have supported it as a policy, which, you know, maybe many in the tech community still wouldn't support it as a policy. The execution of it, and, you know, somebody
detaining five-year-olds is never a good idea. Detaining five-year-olds for following the rules is never a good idea.
And just the pure distraction of it. I mean, these are, like, you think of the numbers, but you think of if one of your key tech employees or your CTO, you know, his grandmother's being held and can't get into the country, that's a huge distraction for your business, even if that individual is not being impacted. The general chaos of it, I think, caused a lot of people in the business community to be very upset, regardless of their partisan.
There's a nice piece in Blue Sky that sort of just explains what these H-1B visas are.
Right. So that's kind of the next wave, where there have been reports that he's considering more restrictions on H-1B visas, which there you get into a somewhat more nuanced issue than the ban that happened over the weekend. The H-1Bs are for more highly skilled tech workers, where employers will sponsor them to come into the country. Those are, you know, the tech industry is somewhat dependent on those in a certain way. But there you hear more of another side of the story, which is that also, you know, theoretically can displace some American tech workers. So I think there you're going to get into a more nuanced debate.
In 2016, 236,000 people applied for an H-1B visa, and what, about 65,000 got them. So there's huge competition for them to get in here and get the jobs, right?
Yeah. And
there's huge competition for employers to find them over there and bring them in here for the jobs.
Yep. Yeah. And that's where, you know, you'll get people saying on the one side, we need those skills that those people bring. And on the other side, people saying, you know, you should be finding those skills here. And there might be a third side, if we can have three sides, it's saying, we know America needs to develop better on those skills. But if you need to hire somebody today, you may need to do this. There's a lot of different aspects to it. And I think when you look at businesses that are tech businesses that are trying to be globally relevant and are, they also have a very different viewpoint. They aren't necessarily only thinking of one thing. They're thinking of a global customer base and global employee base, and it's just more complicated.
Why would you want to limit your potential employee genius base based on something like this?
Right. And then are you appealing to diverse audiences if you don't have a diverse workforce?
Andrea Haynes, the editor of Blue Sky Innovation, she did very well there by not uttering any opinions whatsoever. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Steve. You too.
It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, the Super Bowl coming up on Sunday, and everyone always talks about the ads in the Super Bowl. But there's another game in town as well. 2 weeks ago today, President Trump took the oath of office. He met with business leaders today to talk about the future and his administration, I'm sure regulations, tax reform, and all of that, but pointed out that he and his politics might be bigger than the big game.
Politics has become a much bigger subject than the Super Bowl. This is usually Super Bowl territory, and now they're saying that the politics is more interesting to people.
Well, Donald Trump certainly is shadowing everyone else around him, and Dale Buss is on a phone line now. He writes for Forbes, the Wall Street Journal. He's just got an ad, a story out today in Chief Executive Magazine to talk about Super Bowl ads in sort of that backdrop with Donald Trump and the fact that we all, it seems, are energized on one side or another in this country. Dale Buss, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Well, thanks for the welcome. And it is really interesting that our new president, I guess not surprising that he would conflate the kind of the maelstrom that he's creating with, the annual anticipation of Super Bowl advertising. Entirely appropriate, I guess.
We're going to have a crash or a clash of the maelstroms coming up on Sunday.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's true, isn't it, that the ads, the advertisers, the companies try to be relevant, try to make a comment to get people talking, a relevant comment, but not a controversial comment. And that might be harder than ever this year.
Yeah, I think it is. I think there are two things going on. First of all, I think as a whole, and I've been covering Super Bowl advertising for decades now for various publications, I think you'd have to argue that there's probably a bigger overall effort by advertisers to tap into the, you know, political zeitgeist, the background, what people are talking about than ever before and more directly. And then the second thing is the context is already so highly charged and sensitized anyway that, there can be a lot of interest in these ads on that basis. I mean, for instance, Audi, has been known for this trademark Super Bowl humor for years. You know, you might remember they had Kenny G in an ad several years ago. And then a few years ago, they had a vampire ad at the height of the vampire craze, where they kind of made fun of that whole thing. But it's always been funny, and they've never gone directly at a social issue utterly without humor. Well, that's all changing on Sunday because they've got an ad that's called Daughter. It's basically the story of a girl who wins a soapbox derby against a bunch of, you know, little boys, and her dad's very proud of her. And the whole point of the ad, and what he says this, is to promote gender equity in the workplace, you know, in terms of compensation and all that. It's just a very jarring sort of departure for this brand. And Audi's not the only brand doing that kind of thing.
I want to talk about some of those, but let's back up just a little bit. So you're not necessarily an advisor to CEOs, but if you were, or CMOs, I mean, it's got to be a very delicate balance that they're striking. Now, gender equality is probably safer than ads that we'll talk about immigration and things like that. But
sure. They've
got to be a little leery of what they're doing.
Well, yeah, and what's interesting is, you know, you've mentioned the whole context here. I mean, CEOs have to be leery and very careful about what they're doing, and CMOs, not just in the Super Bowl, but obviously the context is what's going on with the incredible interaction between the new presidency and CEOs. So you have a lot of CEOs speaking out or being forced by Trump to speak out, especially about issues like, you know, Mexican manufacturing and now immigration, who never has spoken out before. And then there are some like Howard Schultz of Starbucks who always speak out, you know, who are speaking out too. So that is the whole backdrop of things. And now you've got some of these brands really kind of either taking on issues in the Super Bowl or maybe skirting them or maybe even unintentionally. So you run the risk, I think, if you're a CEO or a CMO, of being seen as almost too relevant in a sense or trying too hard a little bit. And I think we could be coming up to the edge of that kind of thing. So it'll be really interesting to see how this stuff plays out.
Tell me about this ad for 84 Lumber. It was a local ad, I think, in Pennsylvania that got rejected.
Yeah, I mean, they wanted to do an ad that, you know, kind of went right at the immigration issue. I haven't seen the ad or anything, but apparently it featured a wall. You know, actors were Hispanic. It was clearly addressing, you know, in a negative way what Trump has been talking about with Mexico, and that was before, you know, really the immigration ban against these seven mostly Muslim countries. And, you know, Fox just said, no, you know, too controversial. So that shows there is an edge here. There is a balance here. And some companies, you know, want to go right up and over it.
Anheuser-Busch is going to take it on a little bit anyway.
Yeah. Now, there I think, is an example of what I said, where a company almost, I don't know, is backing into controversy. I mean, when they produce this ad, which they've got several in the Super Bowl, but the one in question shows the story of the founder of Anheuser-Busch, Adolphus Busch, and when he immigrated from Germany to St. Louis back in the mid-1800s. Well, that's a great story, and you know Budweiser is going to do a great ad.
Right.
And the marketing guy for Bud said, hey, it's a story about, you know, people have a dream, they work very hard till they make the dream come true. Okay, great, everybody admires that, and I'm sure it's a great ad. Now the context suddenly has shifted to, you know, this raging debate over immigration in general.
Wow.
So it might be easy for viewers to say, oh, they're trying to do something, when maybe they're really not.
That's a great observation. So what they're really telling is the quintessential American story.
Yeah.
But in 2017, in February, that story is a much more charged one than it would have been any time in our history.
Yeah, or it certainly can be.
Dale Buss wrote the latest article in Chief Executive Magazine, but you've seen him in plenty of other spots as well. Thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate
it. You bet. Nice to talk with you.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, 1237 on this Friday afternoon. All right. Beth Koblenner is on a phone line. She's got a new book out called Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You Are Not, and she wants you to make your kids cry in the store. Beth.
That's right, Steve.
Welcome.
You got it.
Welcome to the Business Lunch. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
All right. I want to start with your title first, How to Make Your Kids a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. Can you really do that if you don't handle money well? Can you teach your kids to do it?
That's the point. And my favorite thing someone said about my book so far is that the secret is it really teaches you, a parent, to know the basics of everything from compound interest to saving for the future, to how to get out of credit card debt, but it doesn't in a way that helps you explain that to your own kids. We have so many scripts in life on how to talk about sex, how to talk about drugs, how to talk about alcohol, but when it comes to money, we don't really know how to do it, and that's why I wanted this book to be clear and helpful and kind of fun for parents to teach kids about money in everyday moments.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is it because we're afraid of drugs and alcohol and sex, but we're not as afraid of money trouble as maybe we should be?
I think money is just the last taboo. I think that we have been so clearly, you know, informed about the dangers of alcohol or early drinking or, you know, so I think that safe sex, I think those are topics that have been such in the minds and psyches of society as they should be. But now I think money has slowly crept into that space. And, you know, little kids see parents swiping credit cards and, you know, magically coming up with a way to buy things on the computer. In our day, you know, my day, probably older than you, Steve, and in our day, you know, sitting down and filling out that checkbook, watching my dad do it at the kitchen table, that doesn't exist anymore. And so it's really important to talk to little kids about where money comes from. I have a job. Cash is money, giving kids cash, not debit cards or credit cards. I think that awareness really needs to grow, and that's to start with families, starting with young kids.
Okay, let's go to the Target store. The kid's in the cart, you're pushing him around, and he reaches for a new toy that he wants. And I say no, and he starts crying, and you say, that makes me a great dad.
It does, as long as you don't give in. You say, you know what? I know it is so hard. There's so many things mommy or daddy wants in the store too. Look at that. But we have to wait and save up our money. And I know it's hard for you. And then the next time you go in the store with your kid, you say, look, we're going to go buy diapers and we're going to buy a bike or whatever it is you need to buy in the store. And we're not going to buy the thing you're crying for. That is not the thing we're going to get. And it shows, research has shown that if you give in to a kid many, many times, they will, when they're grown-ups, have more problems with credit cards and debt.
Well, I'll tell you something. I've got two kids in college now, and my younger one just went this year. I was the dad who made his kids cry in the store all the time.
And
Well,
there you go. And how are they with their credit cards?
You know, they're fine, but I really, when they left, one of the things I thought about was I just should have. Why didn't I give him the Beanie Baby or why did I buy, you know, I mean,
it was hard on you, but I'm telling you, they got the message. Oh, well, we have to wait and work for the things we want. And we wait for our birthday and then you start, you know, I really believe, and I've seen it, you know, kids go to college who have gotten what they've wanted and they're just blind to the fact that, hey, one kid I know called her mom and said, oh, somebody hacked into my account. You know, I don't have money anymore. And the mom's like, well, didn't you go out to lunch with your friend? And didn't you tell me you went to Washington, D.C.? You know, all these things kids are spending money on, they're not conscious of. And your kids are. I mean, I would bet that your kids know the value of the dollar, right?
Tell me. Yeah, I guess so. But I did. That was one of the things when I was going through my wistful September that I thought of. Tell me, though, about, you say that the impressions are sort of set by age 6 or 7. That kind of surprised me that you have to teach them these lessons. You have to make them cry before they go into kindergarten.
Well, I think when you say it that way, it sounds mean, but I think that it is, this is research out of Cambridge University in England, you know, and they surveyed they looked at a lot of different surveys, and they were saying that by age 7, some of those habits that we have with money as grown-ups, whether we just sort of feel like spending it right away or impulse control, those are really kind of kicking in by age 7. And I think the point is when you start young and you start talking about these things, needs versus wants, you go into the store and you could have said, you know, hey, we need milk. We don't need chocolate milk. We need vegetables. We don't need veggie puffs. Those kind of conversations, I think, really make a difference. And I also believe it doesn't have to be a drudgery. Even if you're not good with money as a parent yourself, parents are the number one influence on their kids' money behaviors. So I think starting earlier is better.
Seems to me, though, that if all these things are set by 6 or 7, that it's about more than money because...
Values. It is.
Values. Okay, yeah. Because you're not having that many money conversations or they might not be registering. But if your mindset is created by then.
Yeah, I think they see, but also I do think it's not like, oh, it's over by 7. You have plenty of time when a kid is 10 or 13, you know, instead of handing them, here, here's a credit card, you can take it to the mall with your friends, just, you know, sign your name or sign my name. No, you have to give them cash so they know what it means to have money. Or if your kid works, have them save up that money. Although in my book, I also talk about you don't want them to work more than probably about 15 hours a week while they're in high school, because that has it, that studies have shown that can have an impact on grades. So I think they're kind of some basic points that we don't really talk to our kids about that we can. And like you said, you know, by age 7, you know, you're not talking with them about, you know, brain surgery or 401k plan. You could just sort of make it part of your everyday discussions in life. You go to buy a car, bring your kid with you, talk about the interest rate. Opening a bank savings account is so important for young people.
Talk to me, too, about allowance, because parents of younger kids are always going back and forth on that. And two things. First of all, you say that allowance should not be tied to chores. Do your chores and you'll get your allowance. And the other thing is that you've looked at studies, you say, and you're not sure allowance works anyway.
That, to me, was the most interesting part of the book. So every expert for decades has been saying, yes, you should give allowance, don't give allowance. And the bottom line was I looked at over 24 studies, one from England, one from Canada. One showed, yes, giving allowance is good. It gives your kids responsibility. But another showed giving your kid allowance, that makes them a little more entitled. So there's no right answer. I think it comes back to what you were saying. You want to have good values and you want to be consistent. If you say to your kid, you and your son walk into Target, and you say, you know, nope, you can't have that thing. Nope, you got to save your own money. And then the third trip, you're like, all right, I feel bad, I'm going to give it to you. That would have been worse for your son, because it's being totally inconsistent with the message. If you sort of stick to that message, whether you give allowance, a set amount, I don't think it should be tied to chores, because I think chores are part of a family responsibility. And, you know, studies also show, I talk about this in my book, that studies show that when you start chores for younger children, it actually has a positive impact on how they, you know, whether they graduate from school and start a career. I mean, a lot of this starts with kids when they're very young, but it's not too late to talk to your kid in, you know, ninth grade about everything from, hey, there's something called a credit score. I'm going to tell you about this, because one day when you get a credit card, you don't want to mess up even once, because that mark will be on your credit score for
the rest of your life. That's Beth Koblenz, name of her book, To Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. I know you got a talk coming up at New Trier High School, too, for the Family Action Network. That is February 15th. So if people want to look into that, they can hear a lot more from you. Listen, thanks. It was great to talk to you today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And you were a good dad. Don't feel bad. You did the right thing.
I appreciate that. All right, thank you very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on February 3rd, 2017. In the studio now is Dr. Phil Figel, who's the president of the Chicago Dental Society. They got a big show coming up later this month, February 23rd through the 25th, their midwinter meeting. Phil, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you, Steve. It's an honor to be here with you.
All right, so we're going to do the whole show here with no dental jokes, nothing like that.
Thank goodness. I might be able to add some myself.
Not going to say, the drill thing, none of that. I was surprised by the magnitude of the show. I think I read somewhere that this has a $40 million impact on the city?
It does. It's a over $40 million revenue stream for the city of Chicago from our meeting. But if I can back up just a little bit and tell you just a couple facts about the Chicago Dental Society. We're the local component of the Illinois State Dental Society and the American Dental Association.
Isn't the ADA here in Chicago too?
The ADA is up on Chicago Avenue.
Okay.
Yeah. We represent about 4,500 dentists in the three-county area,
wow,
Lake, Cook, and DuPage, with another 3,000 or so associate members nationally and internationally.
I live in Deerfield, and I think every third person I know is a dentist. There are a lot of dentists.
There are a lot of dentists, but they're, you know, they're your friends, your neighbors. They're really the community anchors.
Well, that's kind of the thing I was getting at. You know, I grew up in a small town where there was one dentist and one doctor. And, you know, in those communities or in any community, those are sorts of the, I don't know if nucleus is the right word, but, you know, sort of anchors in local communities.
They are. Dentists were usually community leaders. They would be active in church groups, active in maybe community politics, that type of thing.
Right. So what are the, you know, everything's political right now, mm-hmm. right? And when I heard you were coming in, one of the things I wondered about was we hear a lot about medical doctors and the upheaval over the Affordable Care Act. I would imagine there's an impact on dentists as well, right?
There is, and it's such a tumultuous time with the Affordable Care Act. If I had a crystal ball, you know, I wish I could say which way things are going to go
right.
and how dentists are going to come out of that. So.
Right. But did you have a big impact with ACA when it was implemented?
There is a provision.
Is it less so or not so much?
Not so much. There's a provision that allows children to get dental care under the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
But there's still regular insurance that patients have. So
what is sort of the pressing issue when it comes to the dental society? And well, just out of the meeting, what is it that weighs on you guys and women?
Well, the meeting itself is really a way for all of us to come together as a community. Mm-hmm. It brings about 30,000 professionals together at McCormick Place. And we really get together to study new technologies, learn new techniques. We have 140 clinicians, 225 classes being given
right.
for dentists to come and learn. Dentists are continuous learners.
Have you paid off your student loans yet?
I have. Yeah, many, many years ago.
Well, because another one of my dentist friends, I was talking to him just the other day, and he was talking about how some of these dental schools, it can cost up to $100,000 a year to go to dental school.
Yes, that's true. That's true. It is. Dental education, again, today is very expensive. But according to U.S. News and World Report, dentist is the number one job for 2017.
No kidding.
Yes.
Well, why is that?
I think it's a good balance of quality of life and satisfaction with your work.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But it must be an issue. I mean, you must have young dentists coming out with huge loan debt.
There are dentists that are coming out with a considerable amount of debt. And just because of the cost of education, it's just kind of the price that's being paid now
right.
for it.
So. And so the other thing that when I think of medical doctors, everything's consolidating now. There are these groups, you know, medical groups, whether it's North Shore or Northwestern or, you know, just pick one where everyone seems to have an affiliation. Is there any move like that in the dental industry?
There is to some degree. Dentists from way back when worked in as single doctors in their own offices.
Right.
And it was kind of a lonely type business. You had to come to a meeting like the Chicago Midwinter Meeting to develop camaraderie and fellowship with other dentists and share ideas.
Someone who understood what you're going through, right?
Right. Yeah. And so, but now there is some consolidation going on. There's some corporate entities that are buying up dental practices and employing younger dentists to work in them. It's just another practice modality that's out there.
As the head of the Chicago Dental Society, do you have a position on that? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I just think it's some of the changing modalities that we have in dental practice today. It can be great.
Right.
And single practice can be good as well. It just depends on the personality of the dentist that is looking for a position.
I was looking at different sort of things to talk with you about today mm-hmm. and suggestions. And one of them that jumped out at me was to ask you about how dentists can help with opiate addiction. I don't know where we're going with that. What does that mean?
Yeah, there's a push today to find alternative treatments for pain management.
I got you.
And in dentistry, we deal with a great deal of acute pain. We're very sensitive to that. We see it on a regular basis. And there's been plenty of studies that are out in the literature today that show that opioid use is really unnecessary, that there's other alternative treatments that can control that acute pain.
So it used to be automatic here, take these pills to help you deal with it. Now you're looking
Not necessarily automatic. I think it was the choice of the practitioner thinking that might be a better
right.
alternative, because we didn't have the knowledge that we have based on a lot of testing and literature.
Okay, you tell me, Phil, if I'm wrong, but when I was a kid, I remember getting fillings and everything with no Novocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like everyone gets Novocaine. Have we become a bunch of, you say it right now, we've become a bunch of
no,
big babies
I wouldn't
here?
Say that. No, I wouldn't say that. My father was a dentist and practiced for 42 years in Chicago. He's a life member of the Chicago Dental Society, and he was a Navy man. and he didn't use a lot of anesthetic on patients. And when I came to work with him, I tried to change that tide. So
yeah, it is one of the areas where we've really changed.
It is,
and people don't dread coming as much.
They don't. We try and make it as comfortable as possible with for our patients.
Phil Fidgel is the president of the Chicago Dental Society. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve. Happy birthday.
See that? No jokes. Thank you for the birthday.